From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And California is in a state of emergency with fires raging throughout the state. Firefighters in Los Angeles have ordered evacuations after a fire ignited near the Getty Center Museum. And in the northern part of the state, in the span of 24 hours, the Kincade Fire in Sonoma County has doubled in size. The fire has now been burning for 5 days. Thousands of people there have been evacuated, and more than 940,000 customers have had their power shut off in an attempt to prevent more fires, from the Central Valley all the way to one of the northernmost cities, Eureka. We're joined now by KQED reporter Michelle Wiley. She's been on the ground throughout the weekend. Welcome, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. All weekend, we've been hearing that this Kincade fire has been spreading fast and furious. How much of it is contained?
So at this point, only 5% of the fire is contained. That's actually gone down over the last couple of days, and it's burned more than 66,000 acres.
Wow. And what's the reason for the percentage lowering of how much has been contained?
So I think the reason the containment has lowered is because the fire has expanded pretty extremely overnight because of the wind event that's been happening here. We've had gusts of 70, 80, even 90 miles an hour up where the fire is, and that has just exacerbated things astronomically.
I'm also thinking about resources as this fire continues to spread. Do you know anything about the amount of firefighters, who's coming from where, and there are also all these other fires that are happening throughout the state?
Right. So luckily, you know, CAL FIRE has a pretty robust partner program. They work with a lot of different firefighter agencies. So I saw firefighters coming from all over the state, from other states. Firefighters from Nevada are here, from as far south as San Diego, just from all over the region coming to help out. And there are thousands of firefighters on the ground working to contain the Kincade Fire.
There are also all of these evacuations. How are the shutoffs from PG&E, the state's largest utility company, impacting these evacuations?
So when we think about the evacuations, the PG&E shutoffs really play into the thinking of the folks who are making those decisions. A lot of the evacuations have been preemptive, so that's before the fire has even touched the region. They're asking people to leave. And in part, it's because this fire, as we know, can spread very quickly in a very short period of time. But they're also taking into account how difficult it might be to contact people because of the power shutoffs. Mm. So that's part of the decision-making and why we see mandatory evacuation orders going all the way out to the Pacific coast.
This fire is also threatening the city of Santa Rosa and many of the same areas that we know were impacted by a deadly wildfire 2 years ago. I can only imagine how traumatic this must be to live through this all over again. What are people telling you?
Yeah, so I think that traumatic is the right word to put into play here. So a lot of the people there, maybe their house burned down during the 2017 fire, or they just rebuilt, and now they're experiencing this evacuation and the possible loss all over again. So that's definitely playing in people's minds. But the other aspect of it is because the 2017 fire happened, local officials have learned from that. And I think that's why we see a lot of these preemptive evacuations, why we see pretty smooth evacuations overall. Folks knew this was a possibility. They got prepared for it. A lot of people were ready to go when their cities were ordered to evacuate. And so for the most part, while there is that trauma playing in, there has been, for the most part, a very smooth evacuation.
I can only imagine, though, that it's chaotic, wondering where these people are going, shelters in place, but also these major centers where they can find hotels and family members. Very chaotic. Thank you so much for this update. That's Michelle Wiley from KQED News. Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thank you.
Well, President Trump says he's considering releasing portions of the video from this past weekend's nighttime U.S. military raid in northern Syria, in which Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, killed himself as U.S. troop dogs chased him. Admiral James Stavridis is former NATO Supreme Allied Commander with responsibility over Afghanistan. He's now at the Carlyle Group. Admiral Stavridis, we don't celebrate death. That's what ISIS does. But I know that you join other analysts saying it is a better thing for the world that Baghdadi is gone. But you believe, as others do, that this doesn't mean the end of ISIS?
I wish it did, but it certainly does not. As surely as winter is coming, the Islamic State will come back. The Islamic State is much more than any single transient temporal leader like Baghdadi. It's an ideology. It's profoundly believed ideology by many of its adherents. And it is also a network, Robin. It is disaggregated. It's global. It's deeply embedded on the internet and in the world of cyber. We have not heard the last of this lethal, venal organization, and any semblance of celebration is certainly premature.
Well, what do you make, then, of President Trump's language yesterday? He called Baghdadi, who calls himself a Muslim. Many Muslims would say that he's hijacked their faith, but he called him a dog, which is highly, highly insulting. He was chased to death by the U.S. dogs. When he set off his suicide vest, he also killed his own three children. But to Trump's language, is that militarily something that is a good thing, that maybe followers of Baghdadi need to hear that kind of language? Or militarily, is that the kind of thing that's going to rile up members of the Islamic State even more?
I think there's little doubt that the Islamic State will use the president's comments in highly inflammatory and, I would argue, very effective proselytizing and recruiting efforts. I think it's also the level of operational detail that the president provided, I thought, was beyond anything I've seen another president do. So those are both troublesome aspects of the aftermath of the killing of Baghdadi. I do want to pause for at least 1 second, Robin, and simply say there is something to celebrate here, and that's the professionalism of the armed forces of the United States, both our special operations, our conventional forces that back them up, the quality of our intelligence organizations, particularly our CIA operatives who go into the field with our military. And lastly, we ought to celebrate the fact that the Kurds, who must be feeling bruised and weakened by the U.S. withdrawal, supported us and provided some of the key intelligence here.
Do you also give President Trump credit for okaying the raid?
I do. It's always a difficult decision. I watched both President Bush and President Obama make those kind of tough calls. It's something we expect from the occupant of the Oval Office. I think President Trump clearly made a correct decision here. And by the way, we also ought to point out, Robin, that we were able to recover a great deal of ancillary material, computer files that will help us continue to face the Islamic State.
Do you know any more, though, about how the raid was impacted by the fact that President Trump did announce a sudden pullout of U.S. troops from Syria? The Kurds, who, as you just said, and everyone has said, gave intelligence that helped this raid, they have felt abandoned by the U.S. And we're reading in the New York Times that this raid was well planned before the president made that pullout announcement and that the Pentagon had a scramble to carry out the raid because of the pullout.
I think there is extreme logic to that line of thought. I do not have firsthand knowledge that the raid was accelerated, but the reporting based on my own decade of experience as a 3- and 4-star officer planning and conducting raids like this, it rings true to me. And I think that it's a further indication of the policy failure in simply stepping back from the Kurds, our closest and most reliable allies in northern Syria. And it cedes the battle space, if you will, to Vladimir Putin, the Syrian Bashar al-Assad, the war criminal and dictator. And it also gives a much wider playing field to Iran.
Well, what happens now? Because we're hearing, for instance, that President Trump is considering releasing the video footage of that military raid on the ISIS leader. We know President Obama at one point released the video, but I'm hearing a reaction from you. Your thoughts?
Never good. All it does is provide a study guide to our potential opponents going forward. In my view, no upside to doing that. I think the salient question here, Robin, and you asked it a moment ago, is what next? We have to continue to keep the pressure on the Islamic State. The best way to do that is through international coalitions. We need to convince Iraq to let us continue to use Iraqi facilities so we can base operations out of there. We're going to have to, I think, come to a better accommodation with both the Kurds and with the Turks. That's going to be challenging. And then secondly, interagency cooperation, making sure the CIA, the NSA, the Department of Defense continue the high level of cooperation we've seen. And third and finally, we need to address the challenge that ISIS presents in the cyber world, in the internet. They are going to continue to use that tool very effectively. I think that that is an area that needs more emphasis. That would be my prescription for dealing with the Islamic State going forward.
That's Admiral James Tavridis, former NATO Supreme Allied Commander with responsibility over Afghanistan and author of the book Sailing True North, 10 Admirals and the Voyage of Character. Admiral Tavridis, thank you.
All the best. Bye-bye.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
Clinical trials are important for doctors who are trying to find and test new treatments for diseases. But researchers often struggle to get people of color to participate in clinical studies. Black Americans, in particular, have a distrust that's rooted in past abuses, like the Tuskegee Experiment, a 40-year government study that began in the 1930s in which hundreds of black men with syphilis were told they were receiving free health care, but in fact were never treated with penicillin. Marlene Harris-Taylor reports on a Cleveland physician who is breaking down barriers between one black community and researchers.
Cleveland resident Tom Kamen is getting his blood drawn at Cleveland Clinic.
Let's take a look at your veins, your beautiful veins, right?
But his specimen won't go to a typical medical lab for analysis. Instead, it will be frozen and placed in a special temperature-controlled freezer in the African-American Biobank in the clinic's Lerner Institute to be used for future research studies. During his office visit, the nurse reads a consent form to Kamen about how his specimen will be used.
You understand there's no benefit to you. There's no compensation. You understand all of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Kamen says he's aware of some of the frightening stories of past research abuses, like the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. The Centers for Disease Control calls it an unethical 40-year study where some black men were lied to and never given penicillin, so researchers could study the progress of untreated syphilis.
Well, we don't forget that easy. You know, it probably won't ever go away.
Kamen says he's okay with the clinic keeping his blood specimens forever because of his relationship with urologist Dr. Charles Modlin. Dr. Modlin came up with the idea to develop the African American Biobank a few years after he started a minority men's health fair. The event provides free clinical services once a year. It attracts hundreds of African American men.
Do you have a history of high blood pressure?
Not that I know of. That's why I'm here to get checked out.
Dr. Modlin says he was reluctant at first to approach the men about saving their blood for use in research studies because of the history. He says he didn't want to be seen as one of the researchers who only reaches out to the black community when they want something.
I and other individuals have developed a presence in the community, and that's been intentional. And so we spend a lot of time in churches and other organizations.
After he built trust with participants who came back year after year, he started asking some to agree to be part of the biobank. He believes this is the only biobank in the U.S. dedicated to specifically obtaining African-American samples.
We want to make those samples available to any investigator, essentially worldwide, who wants to dedicate a portion of their research to eliminating healthcare disparities, to investigating the pathogenesis of a lot of these diseases that we see that are more common, especially afflicting African-American males.
For example, African-American men have a 60% greater incidence of developing prostate cancer and are twice as likely to die from stroke, he says. Several Cleveland Clinic researchers have used the biobank specimens, including one study that's trying to discover the gene associated with heart disease and heart attacks in African-American men. Case Western Reserve University Professor of Bioethics Suzanne Rivera is very involved in overseeing research practices locally and on the national level. She says the lack of diversity in participants is a big problem. For many years, scientists felt it was safer and more ethical to use the white man as the gold standard.
That white male body was treated almost like the prototypical human, and whatever information was derived from studies based on that population were assumed to be broadly applicable to everyone. More recently, the National Institutes for Health, NIH, and university researchers and ethicists have been emphasizing that inclusion of all populations is important.
Rivera says researchers need to do more to attract diverse participants, such as having flexible hours so people can plan around their workday, and having more meetings off campus in places like churches. Dr. Modlin's patient, Tom Kamen, says he lived in the neighborhood around Cleveland Clinic for 66 years, but was never asked to participate in a research study, not until he attended the Minority Men's Health Fair.
It's just now being, you know, that we feel comfortable about coming here, that we know we can get here and get in here and get the same treatment.
For Here and Now, I'm Marlene Harris-Taylor in Cleveland, Ohio.
And now to some news out of Detroit. The longest-serving African-American lawmaker in congressional history has died. Former Representative John Conyers Jr. passed away on Sunday at the age of 90. To talk more about his life and legacy, we're joined by Todd Spangler, Washington correspondent for the Detroit Free Press. Todd, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you're in Washington right now. What's been the reaction to Conyers' passing?
Well, it hasn't been anything like the reaction was for Congressman Cummings, who died last week. It hasn't been anywhere near that sort of level outpouring of emotion, largely because, you know, Congressman Cummings was in office at the time that he died. And even though there has been a lot of outpouring of grief from people who knew Conyers well, who were members of the Michigan delegation, you're not seeing the same level of response from Speaker Pelosi and some other folks that you might otherwise expect. And I think that's because of the way Congressman Conyers unfortunately left office in 2017 under the cloud of some sexual harassment allegations.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit more about that. Conyers was known as a trailblazer on Capitol Hill. He co-founded the Congressional Black Caucus. He was a driving force pushing for reparations for descendants of slaves. Rosa Parks worked in his office at one time. He's right. Responsible for what we now know is MLK Jr. Day. But as you said, he was later in life dogged by these sexual misconduct allegations. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, and the doggedness of that, the way it happened was very sort of sudden. There had always been sort of rumors floating around with Congressman Conyers about whether or not he was, you know, involved with people or not. But ultimately, this came down very quickly at the end, right at the height of the Me Too actions
movement,
were happening
yes.
across the country. And it came out that he had made a secret settlement with somebody who had worked in his office, who had left the office, and who had apparently, she said, had a relationship with him. You know, and then some other people came forward and said that they had seen or had been sexually harassed by the congressman over certain years. Now, he denied that. He throughout said that that did not happen. There was never anything like that. In terms of the money that he paid to this one staffer, he said that that was sort of severance. He said that she had done a lot of great work in his office and deserved some sort of money for leaving the office. And that's what he claimed it was. So there was this cloud all of a sudden, and he went from being the Democrat atop the House Judiciary Committee, the first black congressman to have that role, and suddenly sort of his career just crashed. I mean, it ended really within a matter of a month, and it was stunning.
And in fact, he actually said that he was retiring and not resigning, even though there were calls for him to resign at the time.
Right.
But in addition to his role in Washington, he really played this significant role in shaping Detroit. Tell us a little bit more about his life before entering public office.
Before Congressman Conyers became a congressman, he had worked for John Dingell, who, you know, was the longest serving member of Congress in its history. And, you know, Conyers worked as a legislative assistant to Mr. Dingell before a new district was created. And this is at the time when black Detroit is really coming into its own. He's the first congressman, you know, from that area that sort of represents that.
And the first seat in Congress at age 35, yeah.
Right, and holds onto that district for forever. He was a labor lawyer before that, and his dad, also John Conyers, was a pretty well-known labor lawyer in Detroit. And so that's sort of the world he grew up in and came up through. And he was a legend, politically and socially. You know, I mean, the pictures of a young John Conyers standing on the top of a car, you know, in 1967, trying to calm the crowds down with a bullhorn in the middle of the Detroit riots is something that just, you know, sends chills down your back. I mean, he was absolutely bold, very strong congressman for the place and the time.
It is complex, but given his expansive career and this later sexual misconduct controversy, how do you think his legacy will be remembered?
Boy, it's really difficult to say. I mean, I think that for people in Detroit, for Black Detroiters particularly, he'll always be remembered as a champion of their rights. And I think to a certain degree, some people will feel like he got railroaded out of office. I mean, there were people at the time in Detroit who felt like he was not getting the treatment that somebody else might have gotten, the way people sort of turned on him pretty quickly and decided that they wanted him out. I think in Detroit, he'll always be remembered as somebody who first and foremost thought about civil rights, who just believed that America was not fair to people of color. And he'll always be remembered for that, despite the way that he went out. I think that for people in Washington who went through that period, it'll be a more of a mixed bag because of the way he left. But in his district, he'll always be a legend.
Conyers is survived by his wife, two sons, and a brother. In a statement, Conyers' family says, quote, "Congressman Conyers was a devoted father and husband, and his world revolved around securing justice against racial and economic discrimination." Todd Spangler with the Detroit Free Press, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
And this is another big news week, including a number of major developments today on Brexit. The European Union is giving the UK another three-month extension beyond Thursday's deadline to come up with a way to leave the EU. Meanwhile, the British Parliament is voting today on whether to say yes to Prime Minister Boris Johnson's proposal of a general election on December 12th. So let's bring in our Brexit correspondent in London, Jeremy Hopson, is there with the Here and Now team. He'll be hosting the show from the BBC later this week. Jeremy, well-positioned. Hi.
Well, you know, Robin, whether it is Brexit or Downton Abbey, you can always count on the Brits for some good drama.
That's true. So start with the extension. I mean, to be clear, does this mean there's no chance of Britain crashing out of the EU this week with, say, no solution to problems like a border for Northern Ireland because of some kind of trigger? I mean, that can't happen, right?
That looks like that is off the table at this point, even though you'll remember that Prime Minister Boris Johnson had said that he'd rather be dead in a ditch than extend the deadline beyond this Thursday. Now, he was required by law to ask the European Union for an extension when he couldn't get his deal for a cleaner Brexit through Parliament fast enough. They granted that extension today, although, Robin, they're calling it a flextension because they say if Britain can get Parliament to agree on an official clean withdrawal bill sooner than the end of January, then the extension could be cut short.
Oh, well, meanwhile, you mentioned Parliament. They're voting today on whether to hold an election in December. How does that fit into all of this?
Right. So basically, Boris Johnson is the leader of the ruling Conservative Party. Now, he could wait to hold an election, but they're looking at the polls and they're saying, well, if we held one now, we'd do very well. The Conservatives would do very well. The Labour Party, meanwhile, is looking at the polls and saying we wouldn't do very well. So they have actually today instructed their members, the Labour leader is Jeremy Corbyn, has instructed members to abstain from the vote today. Boris Johnson would need 2/3 of the parliament to say yes to an election on December 12th. So he is likely to lose this vote today. But the other two smaller parties, the Liberal Democrats and the Scottish National Party, have proposed having an election on December the 9th instead of the 12th. So they may put that on the table this week. And the reason they want to do it on the 9th, by the way, is because students would still be in school on the 9th as opposed to the 12th. And they think that they would get more votes if they did it that way. So that's where we are on that. Yes.
With all of this, what does it feel like there? You reported before primarily on Brexit from London. What does it feel like now?
It feels like a country that is in limbo right now. Not that much, if you look at it, has changed since we were here last year, except that there is a lot more frustration with the government, frustration that there are no easy answers to this. No matter what happens, Robin, half the country is going to feel that it's unfair to them. Mm. Now, Sky News here in the UK, one of the news channels, has had a countdown clock every day on their screen that showed how much time was left until Brexit. They took it off today. But they also, just to give you a sense of the frustration, have an entire channel that shows everything other than Brexit. So if you just have had enough of hearing about Brexit, you can watch this other channel. But we are going to have a lot of really interesting stories this week, Robin. People young and old, left and right. We've got Peter O'Dowd of Here and Now, who's going to be reporting from Berlin to give us a sense of how people in mainland Europe are feeling about all this. And of course, I will be speaking with my 93-year-old grandmother here
in
the UK.
I want to hear how she feels. Here Now's Jeremy Hobson at the BBC in London. Thank you. Look forward
to Robin.
It.
On the campaign trail, there's been lots of talk about ways to help the 39 million Americans living in poverty. Democratic candidates Cory Booker and Bernie Sanders have both recently rolled out poverty policy plans, specifically ways to help the children of those families most impacted.
It is not moral, it is not acceptable, and it is not sustainable that the top 1/10 of 1% now owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%.
I live in a low-income black and brown community. I see every single day that this economy is not working for average Americans.
Cory Booker speaking there, and before him, Bernie Sanders. We wanted to take a closer look at what child poverty looks like in America right now and why there hasn't been much change in the number of kids living below the poverty line since 1969, according to Pew Research. Nisha Patel is managing director of Narrative Change and National Initiatives for Robinhood, a New York City-based nonprofit focused on fighting poverty, and she joins us now from New York. Hi, Nisha.
Thank you, Tanya. Thanks for having me.
So when you were with the U.S. Partnership on Mobility from Poverty, you and your team took on this really big question. What would it take to dramatically increase mobility from poverty? And so you guys went to 30 communities, places like New York City, the Mississippi Delta, Silicon Valley, Detroit, and you found that where a child grows up really impacts mobility. Tell us more.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of our U.S. partnership members put it best when he said, today, when it comes to poverty in the United States, zip code matters more than genetic code. So where we are born and where we grow up can have a huge impact on future outcomes. For children who are born into poverty, so the bottom 20% of income, based on where they were born, but when they got to be adults, what were their chances of moving out and up to the top? And if you can imagine a map of the United States, you see vast differences. For a child, for example, born in the Mississippi Delta into poverty versus a child, as you mentioned, born in Silicon Valley, right, in the San Jose area. And so even in places where you see significant job growth, that doesn't necessarily automatically mean that there are great opportunities for everyone or that opportunity is equally distributed in those communities.
Yeah, so it's really not surprising that you also found that gender, race, and immigration status also matters. In what ways?
You know, we looked very specifically, and you could look at it in a number of ways. We looked specifically at wages. And sometimes there are these, you know, inaccurate notions that if people are living in poverty, it's because somehow they're not working. And what we found is that, in fact, is not the case. And so we looked at data around who is working in low-wage jobs, and we used $12.50 an hour or less. And what we found first when we looked at gender was that when we look at white men, only about 20% of white men are working in low-wage jobs, and that number is much greater for women. And then we said, well, what if we then – you know, it's important to look at the intersection of issues. So what if we crossed, you know, gender with race? So I just mentioned white men. So we have far more, for example, black women. So what, 20% of white men are working in low-wage jobs. Double that number, 40% of black women are working in low-wage jobs, and then 46% of Latino or Hispanic women. And then we said, okay, it's really important to look at immigration status as well. More than 60% of Hispanic women who are non-citizens, and that includes women who are legal permanent residents, 60% are working in low-wage jobs, right? So that's triple the percentage of white men.
Were there any surprises when you went into those communities? Maybe things you didn't expect to learn.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was one of the most powerful things that we did. And I felt so strongly about it because I've had the good fortune to sit in a lot of privileged positions in government and philanthropy. And one of the things I have realized and have tried, really spent my career trying to combat, is this idea that, you know, people who are closest to the challenge, people living in poverty themselves, are rarely at those tables when decisions are made. And it's one of the reasons I felt so strongly we had to spend time in communities actually breaking bread, speaking with people who are experiencing poverty. And you learn from that things that you maybe just, even with the best data and research, don't come through. So, for example, you mentioned we went to Silicon Valley, and we went there because it is one of the communities historically for children who are born into poverty where they have the best fighting chance of getting out. So we wanted to say, well, what's going on there? What's the context? And is that still true today? It's true historically, but is it true today? And so we were having a conversation, breaking bread, having lunch with some parents, primarily women, in the Mayfair community in East San Jose. This is the neighborhood where Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez began their organizing. We kept talking about over lunch this idea of being in Silicon Valley, and we're having this conversation in simultaneous Spanish-English interpretation so that everyone could participate in their own language, in their own voice. And one of the women stopped us, and she said in Spanish, "What is this word you keep using? What is Silicon Valley?"
Oh, wow. And she lived right in the heart of Silicon Valley.
She lived in the heart of Silicon Valley. And you could hear a pin drop because I think it struck many of the folks in our group, particularly the academic scholars, how sort of, I think, illustrative that is of both the cultural and economic divide that exists, right? These are families living within 30 minutes of the largest tech companies on the planet, yet never the twain shall meet.
There's this new report that discovered many families lose their Medicaid health care because of these confusing rules and procedures that they have to go through to seek care. I know that you all focused very much at looking at the reasons that folks are in poverty, but I can imagine this type of challenge kind of has a cascading impact for families who are just scraping to get by.
I think that's absolutely right. So, you know, healthcare is just one aspect, but if you think about a family or a household budget, right, healthcare is one of the high costs. Childcare is another high cost. Housing is another high cost. And so thinking about how does a family that's struggling make those choices? Do I pay for medicine? Do I pay for the doctor? Do I pay for food? What can give? And, you know, honestly, those are all basic needs. I don't think any of them can give.
I'm just thinking about how systemic this is, how over time we've seen this generation after generation. President Lyndon B. Johnson famously declared the war on poverty back in the 60s. And during that time, that declaration really unleashed this funding to spur economic growth for poorer communities. But all these years later, we're seeing these same statistics, these numbers, these disparities. Based on your research, what are you finding where we're seeing the need for perhaps government intervention, maybe in the way that we saw during Lyndon Johnson's time?
one of the reasons we need government intervention is when there are market failures, right? And so when we have people working very hard and not making the kind of wages that can support a family. You know, for example, we looked at data from the National Low-Income Housing Coalition that found that nowhere in the country can a minimum wage worker who's working full-time afford to rent a modest two-bedroom apartment. Mm. And that's typically looked at, you know, are you paying more than 30%, right? More than about a third of your income every month for rent. And they found that that was the case even in places that have higher minimum wages, right? Like in some urban areas, places like Seattle, places like New York and Washington, D.C.
Based on your findings, what are some other recommendations for policy leaders in tackling poverty? I mentioned some of the Democratic candidates. Cory Booker is pushing for a $300 monthly cash allowance to families with young children. Will that really be enough to spur what you're talking about, which is really talking about overhauling change and providing and spurring economic opportunities for folks?
It's certainly a start. You know, one of the best things we can do to help families with young children or young children themselves move out of poverty is to increase the income to their families, right? I always say that if you care about children, you've got to care about their parents. And we've got good research that shows that, you know, an infusion of increased income, you know, in the range of $3,000 a year when children are young can actually have a pretty big impact on their later workforce earnings as adults. So it's one of the very best things we can do. And so while $300 a month doesn't seem like a lot of money perhaps, it's definitely a start and can make the, you know, big difference between, you know, a family being able to afford diapers, right? Other resources for their children, tutoring, access to extracurricular activities.
Nisha Patel serves as the Managing Director of Narrative Change and National Initiatives for Robinhood, a New York City-based nonprofit focused on fighting poverty. Thank you so much, Nisha, for joining us.
Thank you, Tanya.
Here's an interesting stat. 60% of Uber riders never tip their drivers. That's according to data from 2017, published recently in the National Bureau of Economic Research. Researchers looked at 40 million data points from a few weeks of UberX rides and found drivers were tipped in just 16% of all rides. Men tip more than women, but most of the difference was men giving higher tips to younger women. For more, let's bring in Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington, as he does every Monday. Derek, welcome back.
Great to be here.
And, you know, for people who don't know, Uber even has a prompt, a window that comes up and says, here's a picture of your nice driver, or words to that effect. How much do you want to tip them? And it gives you choices. But even with that nudge, they still don't tip. Now, this might tell us about tipping in the gig economy. You say it's about something bigger in the U.S. economy?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting little microcosm of Americans' relationship with tipping altogether. So I think that most of us think about tipping as a way to encourage good service. And to prove that tipping in this case works, you would have to show that higher tips are correlated with better service. Mm-hmm. But what this paper seemed to explain in a very clear way is that most tipping has absolutely nothing to do with the qualities of the service. It has way more to do with the qualities of the server and the served. So most tips have nothing to do with the driver. Men tip more than women, mostly because they tend to tip younger women. Tips are higher early in the morning and later at night. The gender of the riders makes a huge difference. How long the trip is makes a huge difference. And only after you take into consideration all these factors that nobody can control does the quality of the trip seem to factor in slightly. So I think in many ways what this study does is provide evidence that our relationship with tips is essentially a fallacy. It's a fallacy that tips are a good way to encourage good service. They're just a reflection of some random forces that people can't control.
Well, you know, Derek, I read this as well, and I took away that I think the fallacy is the assumption that that's why people tip, because I don't tip to try to improve the service. I tip because generally I know whoever I'm tipping is low wage, and I want to make a nice gesture towards them. But if that's why a lot of people are tipping, then they're not doing it, you know, in that case either. Could this have something to do with Uber? Because this was right after tipping was introduced in Uber in 2017. Before that, there wasn't a tip.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point. And I think embedded in those questions are two questions that I want to get at really quickly. First, it is, of course, possible that people tip more in Uber than they did in 2017. I would hope that as the country gets richer and richer and as wages continue to grow, that people tip more in general, whether it's the little tip for your coffee person or the tip for the Uber or Lyft driver or the tip for the hotel maid. My hope is that, you know, we help low-income workers earn more. I mean, that's a lot about of what the last segment was about, that there are low-income people working in this country who can't afford to live where they happen to work, and that is a national crisis. But I do think it goes to this larger issue of how do we want to compensate people in this country? If there is an assumption that a good part of a person's salary is expected to be crowdfunded through tips, that means that they rely on the kindness of strangers.
Right.
They rely on the kindnesses of Robins. But the fact is that we are not a nation of Robins. We are rather a nation of Americans where only 1% are tipping consistently in Uber rides.
Right.
And that, I think, should force us to reckon with this entire issue of how do we pay people? Should we pay people through tips, or should we raise wages and say we can't afford to cross our fingers and hope that we'll crowdfund our way to above poverty wages?
Because there you get into the fact that employers might count on that, you know, thinking, well, I'm going to lower the wages because people will make up for it in tips. Some restaurants have been trying to implement no tipping policies, but we spoke with one owner who said going gratuity free backfired because customers didn't want to have their tips made up with a little increase on, you know, items in the menu. They want cheap items on the menu. And yet, you know, what a catch 22 if they're not going to do the tipping.
I get that. And you know what? Here, I would say culture is sticky, right? If there is an expectation that prices should be low, but then that you should tip above the low prices, that's a difficult culture to change. And it's difficult to change that culture on a restaurant-by-restaurant basis. If one restaurant essentially says, we're going to raise all of our prices by 18% and let go of tipping, well, then that restaurant just seems 18% more expensive than all the restaurants in the area. I think this is the sort of thing that maybe has to be addressed at a legislative level, whether at the local level, the national level. So one potential metaphor for this is Obamacare, when it was passed, forced qualifying chain restaurants to adopt menu labeling. They essentially said, all these restaurants, you all have to put a label on your menu that says how many calories are in this food. Maybe you have a similar sort of national guarantee that qualifying national restaurants have to include tips. They have to raise the prices of everything that they're selling by 18% if it's a sit-down place, so that you're avoiding having to put the expectations on tipping on customers in the first place. In general, I understand why tipping exists. I get that people feel aristocratic when they're being served, and they might want to put a little something on top of the tip. But I would just hope that we find ways to pay people more in the first place.
Yeah, this is all food for thought, but people can eat thoughts. So in the meantime, let's tip. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.